As usual, like the best part of the pod happens off the camera, and you sit down and you're like, oh, wait. It's like, no, that was the best part. We got to like start miking up in the elevator on the way up here into the loft before we shoot. So number one, we're both based in Miami.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we meet here in New York, which is great. The comedy about Miami, of course, is that it had this huge crypto moment where it was like going to be the crypto beach. And then obviously what happened. Mm-hmm. We were going to have FTX Arena. It's a fucking disaster. But you just said something that I haven't heard anyone say. You're like, hey, you know, it's like any big and emerging industry, any big and emerging tech, it's like, yeah, well, there's going to be some screw ups. It doesn't it doesn't destroy the entire industry as a whole. And you just, I want you to use that example again, used it as if it was a teenager. Tell me how you look at this because.
Yeah. I think an industry or a company, the process of maturing is similar to how a human being grow up. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to do some dumb things and try new things as a teenager. And hopefully you're going to mature into a more responsible adult and then a professional and have a productive life. Mm-hmm. No one is going to expect a 13-year-old boy to be perfectly disciplined and go home and balance their checkbook. And very much in the same way, I think that the phase of crypto and tokenization and the retail penetration of finance is going through that teenage years of finance. But I can see very clearly that the more mature years of future is ahead.
Okay. Yeah. That's interesting because even, you know, I think long-term about this tech and I think about, okay, you know, there's a reason why we had this quick onboarding. Everyone was involved and then there's this blow up. And then quite frankly, you don't even hear the C word crypto in Miami anymore. It's like, I don't hear anyone talking about it because it was the biggest joke. You'd sit down at a hotel or on a beach and just crypto. And now you don't hear it at all anymore.
In fact, when we talk to partners, mm-hmm. I don't even use the word blockchain or crypto anymore. I use digitization.
Right.
Because the technology is going to be, or already has been, transformative. Mm. You can fractionalize anything. You can automate anything. You can facilitate a transfer of $2 from Vietnam to Miami mm-hmm. with a cent or two in fee. Things you couldn't do a few years ago with the traditional banking system. It's that aspect of the technology that I think is unfortunately for a moment in time get conflated with like the Dogecoin of the world.
Yep, which is now the logo for Twitter.
Refreshed it. I'm like, oh God. Maybe Elon is going to be single-handedly bring back the retail enthusiasm for meme coins again. Yeah,
the pump and dump coins. Elon's got our backs. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, when we were on the way up here, it's like you look at what's happening in Miami and it seemed like that was the way that Miami was going to become this digital first city. Mm. And obviously what happened with FTX happened and there's just been a lot of egg on everyone's face in that space. But, you know, Miami hasn't gone anywhere. In fact, it's still attracting top talent. It's getting more serious and bigger. Obviously, we're here in New York. We're shooting the podcast in New York. We're in the, you know, this is the OG land of building big and bad companies. But there's something happening to Miami still.
You know what I love about Miami and the current Mayor Suarez? Mm-hmm. I think he has a very entrepreneurial startup approach toward building and governing a city. And an early stage investor investing into a founder and an early stage startup, most know that there are going to be changes. The startup is going to pivot. Mm. They back the principle, the intention, the entrepreneurial approach, and the resiliency. And I see that in the mayor and how Miami has proven itself. I'll give you one example. Back in 2020, I was like, guys, some of our operations a Web3 and many of our team members would prefer to get paid in crypto asset, Bitcoin, Ethereum. Our HR department said, no way, no how. 3 months later, the mayor said, I'm going to accept my compensation in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that kind of entrepreneurialism that you rarely see in the private, in the public sector.
Right. Because they're willing to change and experiment, which I believe change and experiment are the dirtiest words in politics, right? It's like, well, no, we're going to do it exactly how we did it yesterday. Oh, and it didn't work yesterday. It didn't work at all yesterday. In fact, it screwed us up yesterday. But we're going to stick with that game plan.
Iteration, changes, experimenting. I think that's the fabric of life. If you haven't noticed, things that don't change a lot are just kind of dead. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Things that do change, trees, birds, compared to tables and sofa.
Yeah.
And they're comparable version of that, I think, in the world as well. I'm all for changes.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, the Really Rich podcast, the whole, like, if I was to like lasso up the whole podcast and say, like, you know, what is this really about? To me, the podcast is about how iteration is the driving force and why everyone, no matter what you're doing, if you're trying to start a tech company, if you're trying to learn how to skateboard, if you're just trying to cook a better, you know, pasta bolognese on the stove, iteration is what allows you to get and achieve what you want out of life. And that's kind of why I'm here.
I love that word, iteration. I actually don't hear it enough. And in fact, the notion of innovation is just the process of iterating and finding the right solution for the right problem.
Yeah. I mean, what, so obviously kind of in this marathon filming day, and I always love to hear, how did you get to the company? Because your valuation is enormous. You've raised hundreds of millions of dollars, right? So how do you get, talk about iteration. How do you go from, you know, you had a background in law, like how did you tilt and turn and find yourself building republic.com? How did that come about? Like, where was the first kernel of this company?
I actually have never thought of my story as a process of iteration. Mm. But now that I think about it, it is. And what have I been iterating? I think personally, iterating to find something that I find meaningful and worthwhile to do and spend my life. So I started out as an attorney. I was at Goodwin and it was fine. But after 2 years, I was like, all right, this is not for me. Mm-hmm. Got into finance, got into academia. Each and every single role, it was about, am I feeling fulfilled? Am I having fun? Mm. And once that stops, you know, some people just stay there and right. get the golden handcuff
yep.
and you have to pay for that bigger and bigger mortgage and right. you're locked in. And next thing you know, you're like 75 and regret.
And you say, hey, remember all those dreams I had?
Right.
I didn't accomplish them.
So what seemed like a very ADD approach toward a professional life or the lack of building a long-term professional life, I think for me, which is the process of finding something that I can relate to and feel meaningful doing.
Okay.
I'm very lucky that once I chanced across the idea of Republic, and it was both a function of chance and a function of intention.
Okay.
Because if the law didn't change in 2016, couldn't possibly launch
this
a business
off.
Model at Republic.
Right.
And if smartphones didn't exist, also not feasible.
Right, right.
So all of these things coalesce, and I think life and quote-unquote success is a function of being in the right time, being in the right place, rather than a spark of ingenuity, in my opinion.
Mm. It's funny because sometimes the spark of ingenuity, it's the wrong idea, but it got you on the road. It got you up. You're off the couch now.
Yep.
Okay. That spark, you know, all right, blah, blah, blah. It's like, wait a second. This is the wrong idea, or the market doesn't respond. You're like,
right.
Well, I'm still standing.
Right.
I'm still working.
Right.
So let's pivot and change. So I have to ask this because was Republic, when you had that kernel, was it a, hey, I can legally do this now? Or were you like, I know that founders who don't have access to VC and there's this fractionalized everything, you know, we can crowdfund everything. Where?
So before Republic, I was on the early team at AngelList.
Ah, okay.
Which was the platform and is the platform that allows for rich, not super rich,
right?
Some, but for people of means,
right,
to invest into tech alongside VC.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say, Uber raised the very first $1 million from a bunch of high net worth individuals on AngelList. Only for high net worth, though.
Okay.
So at that time in 2012, AngelList was lobbying the Obama administration to change a body of law that's been around since the Great Depression.
Wow. Okay.
So after the Great Depression, you got to be a millionaire to invest in private assets. And that changed in 2016. But it was a very intentional effort in working with the government to get that done.
And the reason for that is because back in the day, you know, the market's going one direction. Everyone's saying, pull your money into grandpa's railroad stock, and then everyone gets wiped out. And so that law comes about.
Yes. Now, but to be fair, as often is the case, lawmakers just put in place a body or a parameter that they think would fix it. So I'll give you an example. You can add on restrictions. You can add disclosure requirements.
Okay.
But it makes no sense that a 85-year-old teacher who has been saving their entire life and is a millionaire would somehow the law presume that to be more capable and more sophisticated than someone with a Harvard MBA, student debt, and working at Goldman Sachs as a second-year analyst.
Right. Two different millionaires here.
Well, the other one is not a millionaire because between debt and everything else, it would be negative net worth.
Okay.
And that person, that Harvard MBA Goldman Sachs analyst, would not be able before 2016 to invest $10 into her classmate's startup.
Right.
I mean, it makes no sense.
Right.
Every single year, $100 billion lost at the casino in Vegas, predominantly from average,
average Joes.
Correct.
Yeah.
And lottery tickets, another $80 billion. So, and how often do we buy things for $20 and $50 that we don't wear?
Right.
So preventing access to private markets made no sense. And the Obama administration agreed, and then the Trump administration agreed, and that has changed.
Well, it thwarts innovation from unique corners of the world.
Right.
Because, you know, the people that are the outsiders, you know, not the guys that are the YC alum who have the pedigree, they're like, how the fuck do I raise any capital? Well, how do I get, I have everything else. How do I get the money? So was your first iteration for Republic.com as it is today? Like, did you start, what was the MVP? You built this marketplace? How did you start with this product?
So when the law changed, I still remember in May 2016, that's the first month that you don't have to be a millionaire to invest in private assets. We launched the platform, went out there, curated four startups that we found to be promising.
Okay.
But also the startups had a story, a mission that we think resonated with the general public.
Okay.
So that behind a computer screen, someone can look at this and say, hey, someone is selling a fabric that repels mosquitoes without damaging the body of the child if she was pregnant. And as it turned out, these things really were successful on a platform like ours.
Right. Because We're a product that might be huge upside opportunity, but with perhaps maybe too technical or something, you know, three or four levels into an engineering process, it doesn't have the same level of appeal on a platform like
Correct.com. Because for the retail public to invest, it's both with their heart and with their head. And the smaller the amount, the more relevant how much they relate, how much they resonate with what is being built.
Okay.
And the smaller the amount of money or the minimum investment amount, it's less about return on capital. It's about being a part of something that you care about and hope that there's an opportunity that it works and you get something out of it. But it's about learning, about belonging, about things that makes people happy or unhappy.
Right. And we were goofing around before. It's like what we saw with NFTs was they tried to tokenize the upside and the club, and things went haywire with NFTs. But what didn't get lost or pulled from society is the idea that I believe in this thing. I believe in this person. I believe in this product. I believe in this, you know, I don't want to name a specific spreadable, you know, product. I don't want to name any things that because I know a couple products on your site. And this is a vehicle for me to do it. And on a regulatory level, it's a lot safer. Mm. Yeah.
Can I give you a hypothetical scenario that hopefully one day won't be hypothetical?
Okay.
You have tens of millions of fans who love your show, M1. Imagine next month you decide to raise a certain amount of money and you tell everyone, I want to pay back 10 or 20% of my revenue every single month back to this batch of investors for 3 years.
Right.
So now all of a sudden, you allow people, let's say a million of people to come in. And in addition to issuing a share, they get a unique NFT that signifies that they're an investor in Mr. Crown.
Yeah.
And when they go out to brunch, they turn up their phone. Right. And all of a sudden, a bunch of friends would be like, how did you get in early? Right. And they can buy and trade these securities.
Right.
You know, I think it's a whole new batch of belonging, of a way that people flex and showcase their affiliation, how they fit into different pockets of society.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm on a very personal level, right? So I run my content business one way and I see how other folks run their content business. What I see creators have is they getting to the next level, it takes capital. They need capital to rent the studio space. They need capital to get the best video talent and the new gear and equipment. And so sometimes the difference between a creator continuing to grow and prosper is a matter of capital, especially if you're in, you know, I'm in the financial startup niche. So, you know, it's nice to find great partners like, you know, Republic.com. But if you're in a further out niche, you might not have brand partners ready to help out and lend a helping hand. And you might want to, you don't know how to go directly to your audience. So, you describing creators like companies or like funds, I think is really, really interesting because they're media companies. Media companies need capital and media companies throw off cash when things start to work out. So I'm very interested in this. I've heard many people pitch this to me the wrong way with different types of the same old memberships and this and that. It's like, well, people want a little more than membership. You know, people want a belonging. People want return.
Some upside.
Upside.
Some economics.
Yeah.
And the moment that you have upside economics, or for that matter, any instrument that has variable pricing, indeed, most tokens out there are very likely deemed to be securities. Mm. I mean, by a stroke of luck, I started out my career as a securities attorney, and that became very relevant. But compliance, and is feasible, is completely doable in the US and outside to reach a large community of retail fans and followers and users and be compliant with securities law. And I think that's one of the misconceptions that major influencers may have about community engagement through equity.
Mm. Well, it strikes me like a cleaner way to pull this off. I mean, it's, you know.
In fact, I really think that the future of finance, of venture capital, is going to be community funded. Mm. And if a business has a community, that community in time will come to expect that they get a little bit of an upside.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they may switch their allegiance and go to a different business.
Right. Yeah.
So Uber and Lyft, as an example, I think the next Uber or the next Lyft would give their first adopters
a little
skin in the game. They can give away even, you know, a share, half a share.
This is, this is cascading into all of the volume of impressions on social media is driven by professional content creators. Like it or not, you know, mom and grandma post maybe once a week, maybe right. once a month. Right. We'll see that. But really the volume of content is being driven by professional creators. Now, what the phenomenon is, and this is, in my opinion, the breaking point or the inflection point of what's going to happen in social media is the people creating the content, they withdraw, I believe, about 1% of the value they create from social media platforms. It varies by platform. I'm not going to name who's better and who's worse, but we pull about 1% of the whole 100% that we create. Scary, because at some point you're like, what the fuck am I doing this for?
And the other 99% would go to?
Back to the platform. Back to the platform. The platform's warehouse, I strongly believe most of the value created by the content. Now, what you see with certain platforms is they, in this similar way, they return a little bit. They return a little bit. The historical model is the YouTube long form model. They return a little bit of the ad revenue. That's great. The world's moving into short form. The reason we know each other is from short form, right? Short form, and that's, you know, kind of my thing. I love 30-second clips. It's just what I do, right? That, you know, in the long form, okay, we get a little value back. But in the short form, we get 1% of value back. That is problematic for the longevity of the industry. Because
unbelievable.
Unbelievably scary. The general public saying, I like this. I want more of this. And the platforms are saying, well, we don't know how to monetize it. Mm. So we might not give anything back to the people filling your feed with funny, informative, whatever you're into, videos. And this is one way that you've described that I think would be a meaningful solution.
And I think one, I'm sure there will be other platforms if the existing platforms don't change mm-hmm. the business model to make it more compelling. But for the largest influencers, creators, I think there are already existing mechanisms by which you can, I believe, grow with the community, earn more, mm-hmm. much more than just that 1%, mm-hmm. and perhaps share the remaining value
yeah.
back to the community mm-hmm. and scale in that fashion.
I love that. I love that so much because then you're really winning together. You know what I mean? One thing that always struck me, it never sat right with me, was the big YouTuber going from the garage to the house mm. to the mansion to the Lamborghini and showing it off, because his audience is how he got there.
Right.
And that always sat weird with me. I'm like, we paid for that Lamborghini, you asshole.
But I guess that also motivates people to be like, hey.
I want
to
be like him.
Exactly.
But wouldn't it be cool if he was like, yeah, I got this house and the mansion. And by the way, guys, I'm sharing a little bit back with you.
Yeah.
You know, a tiny percent, but hey, we're all in this together and this is a community effort. I mean, what could be more fun than that? Because then it's like, then you're even further aligned to enjoy the content, you know?
You know, we are also pushing new frontier in the music financing world. Mm-hmm. And there's a parallel there because the studio would take 80%,
yeah.
sharing 20% back to the artist. Mm-hmm. And we launched last year the very first song by Lil Pump, the rapper, okay.
yeah.
whereby he raised $500,000
okay.
from his fans. And he pays back a percentage of his earning from that song back to the investor while keeping the rest.
Mm.
It's an example of everyone winning
yeah.
and either reducing or cutting out or changing the model of the middleman keeping
right.
80% or more.
Right. Right. Because we're getting frictionless in so many different areas. I mean, look, I'm thankful for the frictionless ability to deliver what I do to a wide audience. That's incredibly valuable. But again, it's one part of the business has changed light years and the other part of the business hasn't yet.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, that awkward moment when Spotify came about and musicians were like, wait, hang on. You're like, we're still over here. It's like, you know, when Metallica was like, we're not going on Spotify. They're like, oh, well, you will eventually. Yeah.
That's why I'm actually so excited about the near-term future for the world. 2 years, 5 years out between blockchain,
mm-hmm.
AI, and the world of social media converging.
Whew.
connectivity,
the trifecta,
speed of transfer,
right?
And I think you're gonna naturally a more connected world. It's just going to build a more resilient economy. And that's why you haven't seen another major tech crash since 1999 and, you know, 2000. Right. So in very much in the same vein, I'm no financial advisor, but I'm actually less gloom and doom about the next 12 to 24 months than, you know, many perhaps folks on Wall Street.
Yeah. I'm on your side there too. Because what happened was a scary thing and an incredible renaissance. It was like crypto, blockchain death, and then like 5 days later, right. It was like ChatGPT, like, hey, we're going to be fine, everybody. You know, now everyone's building something on the back, including myself. Everyone's building something on the back of OpenAI, right? And then we have, in my opinion, we have an equal amount of psychotic amount of value to society. Disruption for some, definitely. But as a whole, better. I have a very rosy opinion and picture of AI enhancing all of our lives, allowing us to work a lot less on things we don't want to freaking work on anymore. Right. I mean, oh man.
You know, I would wish to go back in time and be a college student right now, because all of like the literature classes or whatnot, take home exams or ChatGTP. Yeah, exactly. I just asked someone at ChatGTP for to summarize War and Peace into a 10 line poem.
Okay.
And it was incredible and was done in like 20 seconds.
Beautiful.
But other aspects are not replaceable. Human emotion, psychology, how do you operate in the world and read headline news and hear about OpenAI? But imagine if you can have a dollar stake in it, or a new song, music, no longer consumption, but being a stakeholder. I think that kind of a sense of belonging, well, that's biological human needs. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, I think finance, our world is going to be improved, but cannot be eliminated by AI or technology.
Right, right. Well, the way I like to think about AI is it opens you up to do more thinking and less doing, because and that's very democratic, because anyone can be an ideas person.
Yes.
Execution sometimes requires certification, a fancy degree, maybe an MBA, maybe this, maybe that. Now it's like, well, no, you know what you need to do. If you can engineer the prompt, you can get it done really fast.
Right.
And you don't have to go to a great school to do it. And I don't think you should have to go to a great school to do a lot of these different things. And,
agreed.
You know, don't kill me as a you know, former chief counsel, but I had to draft a legal document really fast. And ChatGPT drafted me a beautiful legal document in 30 seconds.
An actual agreement?
An actual agreement.
Wow.
Yes. Done.
Was it a lease agreement, a contract? That is incredible.
It was the agreement that I sent to everyone to come on this podcast.
I love
Seriously.
It. No, I love
Seriously.
It. I think that's incredible.
Yeah.
And this is the first time AI has been a thing for like a decade, for 15 years now. This is the last 6 months, the very first time that AI is relevant to an individual's daily life, whether you're a professional, a student, doesn't matter.
Right.
Maybe not yet my mom. I don't think she's using ChatGPT just yet.
Wait till it's, I think it's already is an app, right? Yeah, it's unbelievable. So what happens as we move into this AI world with Republic? Do we start to see different types of business flowing onto the platform? What does that ecosystem look like? Because, you know, I've, you know, been close to your product, haven't been close to your product yet as someone fundraising, but I feel like by the end of this podcast, I'm like
yes,
I think this will be the third time we're at the end of the podcast. It completely drastically changed my life. What do you see happening in your space and on Republic?
Looking out, I think 5 years to 10 years, I think every consumer will become or very familiar with being a stakeholder and an owner. So let me just walk back a little bit. Say my family immigrated from Vietnam. So when my parents were in their teenage years, people then didn't buy anything that wasn't produced locally in that very village. Mm. Now, obviously, in one generation, everyone around the world, 99%, I'm sure, 95%, consume things that are produced globally.
Right.
From China mainly, right. but also everything else. So everyone becomes a global consumer of things.
Okay.
But almost today, 2023, almost no one, I think it's a tiny, tiny, a fraction of 1%, who actually own and have a stake in things around them that they care about. They can buy things, but they don't have they're not a stakeholder. Mm. And I think that's about to change drastically. Mm. So that notion, to be more specific, I can very easily envision a world whereby in 3 years, you check out of your Amazon shopping cart.
Yeah.
And there's a button underneath each some of the items and say, do you want to invest in this company $100 in addition to buying this package of beer, craft beer?
Right.
You do that, sign a contract, and they say powered by Republic.
Right.
And there's a wallet on the Republic platform. They pay out some 5 cents, $5, a quarter from your $100 investment.
Right.
And that's the relationship dynamically between consumption and investing. I have no question that we're moving toward that future rapidly.
Yeah.
5 years, 8 years, 2 years, time will tell.
Well, number one, if that's a place that we find ourselves in 5 to 10 years, that's the rosiest thing I could imagine, because you move from a consumer to an owner. It's always better to be an owner than a consumer. It's better to own the farm that you get the vegetables from. And it would be an incredible, and it would make sense, because as things get fractalized and broken into these little pieces, ownership is more easily transferable in little tiny little slices.
Exactly. Yeah. And so people can accommodate, can afford to learn. So that future, you're going to see a lot more from not at all rich to kind of rich, and then moving from kind of rich to rich, and then rich to super rich. Mm-hmm. So in the long run, it's going to feed into, you know, your rich versus super
rich. Right. It becomes a skit. The whole thing becomes a skit at the end of the day.
But the reality is that people generate wealth
right.
by and large by investing, by owning.
Right.
And you got to learn that by getting in, by right. actually doing it. You can't read a book and learn how to bike.
Right.
And yet we assume that people should read books and then just dive in and invest $10,000 at a time. So luckily, I think technology, legal changes, and social media, how people connect with one another, mm-hmm. will in one generation change how people's relationship with money evolve.
Right. Well, if we just look at the things for the people that are saying, I don't believe in this at all. Let's just look at the things that now we are fractionalizing, right? Uber's the most obvious fractionalized usage, right? You don't really need a car anymore. Hmm. You can rent one. You can rent a house and a vacation property. Airbnb is like the oldest news in town. It's like, well, why doesn't this get continually squashed and granularized into things that you just haven't thought about?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'll use two examples for anyone who doubts that we actually squarely already in the first inning, not talking about a game, but already in the game. On our platform, on Republic, at one point, not in this particular moment, but a couple months ago, you could invest $200 in a residential condo in Brickell, Miami, or here in New York. Mm-hmm. You know how residential home ownership is pretty much out of reach for everyone.
Right.
When we enable that, you saw a great volume of investors on the Republic platform who had never invested in startups because they don't get the whole binary thing. Mm-hmm. But now they know that, hey, if I put $200 in a condo in Brickell, I'm never going to lose all of it. I understand real estate.
Yeah.
And only now that that's feasible. And the second example is one of my nephews is in middle school over Thanksgiving. So on his phone, I'm like, Clayton, what game are you playing? He's like, no Uncle Ken, I'm trading. I'm like, what are you trading? Crypto.com. What are you buying? Cosmo and Solana. I'm sure the kid lost some money now compared to 6 months ago.
Come on, we got to see his,
no,
his
but
portfolio.
At the time, it was $820 some odd dollars. Okay. And probably now, you know that he now as a middle school uh-huh. is more savvy than I was when I graduated from law school working at Goodwin Procter.
Right.
So it changes people's relationship it already has. The question is, it takes media, entertainment, and influencers to make that more relatable and capture people's attention span. Mm.
Because that's the way that the general, that's the way that the general public, I guess, gets introduced to these fringe and newer ideas. Ah, man, I hate to use the example, but in the NFT world, I guess you could say that like the Paul brothers were driving the train on this, all the eyeballs headed over there because look, crypto, everyone thinks like crypto is like a new thing. It's like crypto has been around for quite a while, right? And it's just in the recent memory that things went parabolic and then crashed in the tulip shaped curve, right? Potentially driven social media.
And I think people are too quick to judge on whether something is good or bad. All right, it's bad if, you know, grandma put all of her saving into an NFT promoted by Jake Paul. But I don't know if there's even a single instance of that. Have people considered the benefit of maybe 10,000 kids in inner school that all of a sudden now take an interest in new technology and learn what non-fungible token even means? The social benefits, I think, are not so easy to just fit a bucket of good or bad. I think it's an evolution and we gotta go with the flow and guide and see how changes are about to come and build with the right intention. And I think if everyone does so, it's gonna be an optimistic future that we're gonna be living in.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting because I don't know what the equivalent would be because when I graduated, hello everybody. When I graduated from college in 2008, perfect timing, financial crisis, I was going to Wall Street. All my friends were going to Wall Street. That's just what we were going to do. But not the whole world wasn't going to Wall Street.
Right.
At the same way that the whole world was trading NFTs and crypto. So in a way it's like, oh, well, as sad as the story ended up for some, what we've done is we've created a generation interested in new technology,
absolutely,
willing to experiment. Yep. Where you're like, hey, it is cool that my nephew is trading on his phone instead of playing Farmville. You know what I mean? It's like, 100%. This is pretty cool.
And I think a lot of it is about education and who can get the attention to get a message through better than creators and influencers. Mm. I read somewhere that people's attention span, not your followers, but generally,
of course,
people's
not my
attention
followers.
Span.
My followers' attention span is hours long, guys.
It's
stick with
9 seconds is what I heard. By the time you're done with saying simple agreement for future equity or equity crowdfunding, you're already done.
Yeah, you're out.
So it takes a joint effort by different sectors, influencers and media, to provide the right disclosure. To give you an example, I guarantee you, one message from you or from Beyonce saying that, hey guys, if you invest privately, don't invest more than $20. Mm-hmm. You're going to reach far more than a firm like Republic or even JP Morgan running billboard everywhere.
Right.
It's just the world that we're living in.
Right.
So how do you inform people to get in and learn from their mistake, but at an amount that they can afford to lose?
Mm. You know, Ken, I wish I met you and sat down with you before I created some campaigns for your company, because I'm understanding what you're doing is a lot deeper than a marketplace of startups and chopping this up into being affordable. It's a lot deeper and there's a lot more emotion that's driving this ecosystem. And I believe that you're tapping into, and the wave is just building. We haven't even seen what's going to happen here.
Can I tell you a personal story?
Yeah.
When I first started at AngelList, this is 2013, I made my very first private startup investment ever.
Okay.
It was in a company at the time was valued at $200 million. Uh-huh. 3 months later, it was valued at $3 billion. Uh-huh. I was so happy. And then a year later, it went bankrupt. That was also the largest investment that I've ever put in a startup because I didn't know.
Right.
It was also the best lesson that I've had. Had I waited for another 10 years to make that first investment, it would have been 20 times that amount. Mm-hmm. And I've learned how to diversify since. So if there's one I think one view, one message or misconception that people have about, oh God, are you going to open up highly illiquid, risky assets to people who don't know anything? Mm-hmm. How are they going to learn if they don't get in?
Right.
In small amount.
Right. And create an environment where there's a story, where the products perhaps have a simpler structure that you can learn, where you don't need to be poring over, you know, the scientific journals and reports to understand what this business is doing.
And if they have gurus or advisor that they trust.
Don't point at me when you say guru.
No, I'm like, you know, I don't know about you, but let's say I consume craft beer and I think that I am more informed about that sector, say, than my mom. Uh-huh. And if someone like my cousin who doesn't drink beer at all and knows that I know this space and she follows my investment, diversify into 50 craft beer brands.
Right.
I guarantee you it's going to be better than if she randomly picks 5.
Sure. Okay.
So over time, the ecosystem will emerge so that people can follow influencers, creators with subject matter expertise mm-hmm. and participate. Mm.
Where do we go? Here's a, I'm like, I'm just going to ask you the most complex question I have in my whole life. It's like, where does the content creator, where does the voice go after social post? I'll tell you what I'm doing after I hopefully get the most amazing answer and I can just write it down in my notebook and I'm good to go. Where the heck do these people go? Where do the big creators go? Do they start creating their own private platforms and private environments? Does social media capitulate and start sharing more value back to the creators? What the hell happens? I don't know what's going to happen. Do you have an idea?
If I do know, I think we should launch a new Facebook, a TikTok, yes. A YouTube.
And we're definitely cutting that part of this out and we're going to...
Nicholas, I think that up until now, those with a following, mm-hmm. influencers, creators, the primary way of activating that following is through commerce, mm-hmm. merchandising, mm-hmm. either content or actual things and items.
Yeah.
And only now at the very beginning, we're at the beginning of a time where that following can be harnessed to actually deploy capital into changes, into technology, into mm-hmm. movement. I think money's energy is like casting a vote.
Yeah.
And so in that way, whether you're an artist, whether you're an influential podcast, personality, the ability to become a new brand mm-hmm. of venture capitalist, I think is something that you're gonna see a lot more influencers entering into
right.
in the years to come.
Right. Yeah. This podcast near and dear to me, guys. I'm like, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm going, instead of going upstream in tech, I'm doing that too, but my next big thing is going old school. I signed a major book deal. Mm. So, and I'm going to write, have the whole thing structured out. Don't worry, editors, if you're listening, it's going to be done when I sign off of the contract. I'm going to pack basically the principles that I talk about into a book, audiobook, ebook, whatever. And then I'm going back upstream to more digital and tech solutions, because I think what, at least from my standpoint here in the financial creator startups, it's like, okay, you've garnered this huge audience really rapidly, but we got to make sure the foundation is there. Mm. You know, where in traditional media, you become a voice through, number one, a lot slower, and I'm impatient, so I'm glad I didn't have to wait that long. But there's some basis, right? And so I'm going back and I'm making sure I'm checking all the boxes in my brand. And again, could I have self-published the book and made fucking 10 times more money? You bet. You bet, Ken. But I'm publishing it traditionally through to top 5 publisher to go through and build the credibility, old school, and then return upstream. I'm calling it upstream. What I mean is just more tech to build those products. And that's where I'm headed next, which I think is it's a unique, people are like, are you crazy? You're gonna freaking have to write a book. And I'm like, well, this is how I know the next thing we do has some gravity to it. because I'm going to distill the way that I think and the whole reason why I think people were captured by the rich versus really rich kids into this book that can help, that hopefully can be a guidebook and a toolkit for people to think a little clearer about how to get what they want and staying humble as well.
I really mean it. What you do and the message, how the messages are crafted and delivered is so central to the Republic's view of what it takes to truly democratize finance and popularize finance. Count me in for a 300 book order.
I got you. Signed.
Every single employee at Republic, I mean, most of us are such huge fans. Appreciate and those that. Who are in the Philippines who don't know about you yet or haven't read, will receive a copy of the book. Who delivers the message matters a great deal in how to get that message through, and doing that at scale itself is a parallel and necessary component of the future of finance that we believe in. Mm.
It's funny. Finance is the last industry that you would think would take on this softer, warmer community side. And coming from the cold, steel mill of Wall Street, the trading floor, I shouldn't believe it. But I do believe it because it's irrefutable. And if you look at the evidence and if you look at the way that everyone adopted NFTs and the communities around NFTs, which again, some of these projects were great, some of these projects were terrible.
Right.
But now we bring some seriousness to this deal. We hand back a piece of what we're working on back to our audience. I don't know, man. I'm starting to see the future a little bit clearer right now.
You need a notion of crowd financing. We're sitting here in New York. Mm-hmm. The Statue of Liberty was crowd financed because they ran out of money.
Really?
And so they put an ad in the Times at the time to get money in. Do you know what?
I didn't know that.
The first rounds of like businesses in Chinatown, in Little Italy, most of them were financed through the community because the banks didn't lend to immigrant communities. Right. So after church, people literally sit together in a room, put the idea in a hat, and then whoever wins the draw would receive money from that community.
Yeah.
And based on social validation, that they wouldn't just run away with it.
Right.
But so it's just coming full circle in a much more interconnected world. So the community can be 18 million followers or can be the entire soccer fandom of United Manchester, Manchester United.
Right. So the principle's the same.
Exactly.
The principle's the same.
We want to belong. We want to cast our identity with things that we care about and share in that success.
Yeah.
I think that's a human nature that's not going to go anywhere.
Sure. Well, look, we're shooting this podcast on top of Chinatown. And if you haven't been to New York, for those who haven't come to New York yet, come on down and check it out because you go through these neighborhoods and you're like, how the fuck is this? There's English and Chinese everywhere.
Right.
You're like, I don't understand how this is possible.
Right.
But then you realize the community funding, the community roots of this neighborhood, turns out they're still here and they're still strong no matter what, I don't get to name any hedge funds or whatever, no matter what, whoever wants to sink their teeth into this neighborhood, they can't.
Right.
They can't. It's so deep and it's so connected.
But, you know, the crazy thing is when the community, when your user becomes stakeholders, it also adds enterprise value to the largest. I'll give you one example. Revolut is a neobank in Europe. Last raised at over $33 billion in valuation led by SoftBank. The few years before that, they raised from the customer $5 million.
Okay.
So that 10,000 customers would go out and evangelize that, hey, we're an investor in this company and they're so excited. And that community amplification value is like marketing, evangelism that was widely attributed to this enterprise growth. Mm-hmm. And who benefited from it also? SoftBank. And if BlackRock invested in it, they would have benefited as well. Right. So it truly is best, it is good, adds value for everyone up and down the financial stack.
Right. Well, it just in terms of marketing dollars and cents, right? So word of mouth moves virally, whereas Facebook ads don't. Dollar in, dollar out. Or hopefully a dollar in, $3 out.
You would know better. I'm not too familiar with Facebook ads.
Well, you know, you're lucky. Consider yourself lucky. The idea is that if you are building a business or you've built a community that's so strong that the, you know, Joe tells Paul and Paul, tells Susie, it's like that moves in a viral J-shaped curve. Mm. And there's no other way to do that besides word of mouth. And that's how you stick around and that's how you grow really, really fast.
If I invested $50 in Absolute Vodka, that's what you're going to get for New Year's, for Christmas, for Chinese New Year, you name it.
Right.
And I'm going to tell everyone that I am an investor. You don't need to know how much I invested. Right. I'm an investor.
Right. You know, it's like, what's the oldest? The oldest thing, it's even in, I don't know if you're a fan of Rocky movies, the boxing Rocky movie. Anyway.
Somewhat.
Okay. Well,
that he's a survivor.
Yes, exactly. The whole thing with when Rocky retires, he opens up Adrian's restaurant and it has a little piece of the story as this restaurant. It's the same thing where celebrities, it's all connected. It's all connecting now. It's like, you know, how many celebrities now are owners in spirits or sporting or whatever than there were in the past? But like, Marilyn Monroe didn't have her own tequila brand, right? There wasn't Monroe agave, right? And this jives very well with this entire story.
And I think Paul Newman in Popcorn, or is that George Clooney in Casamigo? Mm-hmm. And over time, their investment in entrepreneurial affiliation and career may be just as big as their media career.
Mm-hmm. Bigger, let's be honest.
But that's how I think, that's a reach through commerce.
Right.
And now they can each and every single person with a following, with influence, can theoretically, if they're interested in investing in finance, can build a brand in venture capital.
Right. And wouldn't it be cool if you went to the store and you bought the whatever, Clooney's, I don't know how much that guy exited for, some psychotic amount, but Casamigos, right? Mm. Okay. If you were getting a little tiny little check in the mail from Casamigos and you say, right, I can't think of a better way to evangelize a customer base than that.
You would not go off and buy a bottle of Casa Azul, even though it's supposedly even higher end, right? And even more, if on your phone there's a, you know, NFT that shows a photo of that brand of Casamigo or that particular product, and every single month you receive 25 cents, $1.70 on stable coin into your wallet.
Right.
As earning payout from the gross proceeds, you will probably be pumping that Casamigo product pretty hard.
Yeah. It's like what with the Tupperware parties back in the day. You know, you're like, you know, hi everybody. Look, you have to have this Tupperware. It keeps the casserole, you know, whatever. Yeah.
You know how it's funny how the more things change, the more they stay the same. Mm-hmm. All of these elements of profit sharing, community financing, just redux, but more effective in that scale.
Right. Yeah. Let me tell you, Ken, you should occasionally take a look at the comment section in my, there's a small group of people who think that things are going to get worse.
Yeah.
There's a small group of people that think everything is going maximal to a few stakeholders. And I don't see that happening. I don't. On the ground level, I see more people getting access to more powerful tools, cheaper than ever before. I see more power coming back to the individual than to the collective.
You know, I think at the end of the day, very much trying to stay true to my general thesis that things are not objectively good or bad or desirable or not. It just that depends on who you are and your constitution, your likes and dislikes. Pick a mode that resonate with it. So if someone is extremely risk averse and is sitting home very nervous right now, maybe sitting on a stack of $100 bills would make the person happy. But if you believe in a changing world, if you believe in momentum and energy, creating more energy, and if you're an optimist, then even with 50 cents, I would say most people in the US, even homeless folks, a dollar is likely affordable to most. Wouldn't you want to at least participate and try out a technology or a product or buy a crypto asset just to learn what it is? Or do you want to stay on the sideline of the conversation? So to each their own, but I think that's how one should look at it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that's, I guess that is at first principles what happened with NFTs and crypto and the fringe tokens is I want to be part of the conversation around the dinner table, at the bar, at the restaurant, wherever.
But then there was also greed, which is I wanted to be, but I also want to make $1 million overnight.
For doing absolutely nothing.
Right. Yeah. And so as long as you're aware of that risk, there's also nothing wrong with that.
Right.
It's when greed and being ill-informed
start to play together in the sandbox.
But then those examples in turn create headline news and educate many more so that the new generation would learn from it.
Right.
So objectively, what is net-net good or bad? I think it's just an evolving, changing world and each would just follow the best of intention is the way to live.
Yeah.
And the way to build.
I love it, man. You're as optimistic. You're actually more optimistic than me. And now I'm even seeing new paths to optimism here because the model here is with crisis, we learn.
Yes.
With additional crisis, we learn more.
Yes.
And with more crisis, we get stronger. And, that starts to sound like iteration a little bit because we're learning and we're shifting. We're saying, a little more regulation there, a little less there. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think the best way for me to live positively is keep moving forward and don't look too much. You look back in the past to learn, but not to dwell on it. I'll give you an example. And I think my heritage a little bit. Vietnam was a country of war. There was more bombs dropped on a country the size of California than all of World War II combined. So, and now Vietnam is one of the fastest growing economy, probably the number one and number two US ally in the world. And the only way is, all right, things happen and you learn from it and you move on without, you know, being, without dwelling, getting entangled in it. And I think that's my personal philosophy on building and investing and living.
Yeah. It's learn, stay, travel light, right? And keep pressing forward.
Exactly.
Man, I wish I could sit here and talk to you for another 2 hours. This was a lot of fun. I'm going to hang out with you in Miami. That's for sure.
It's such an honor to be here and to share some perspective. I can't wait.
Dude,
many more.
See you again soon. Thanks for coming on, Ken.
Thank you, Mr. Crown.
That's the podcast.